Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. So today I'm in Windsor to talk to Rosie Taylor-Haller, who's the daughter of Catherine Haller, who I interviewed a few weeks ago now, about the loss of her first husband, and then she told me how she was going on to marry again for the second time. Rosie, it's lovely to meet you.
Hello.
I know you were 21 when your father died, which is young.
Yeah. I don't think you're very grown up when you're 21. Maybe you feel like you are, but I don't feel like my dad ever got to know me as an adult at all. And that's something that I miss, because I would have conversations with him now that I wasn't mature enough to have at 21, or ideas that have developed or things that have happened in my life. Like, I've bought a house, got married, I'm having a baby.
Well, those are big things.
Yeah, and that's all happened in the 7 years since he's died. So, yeah, it's been very profound, and although it's not, you know, the youngest you can have a parent die, I did feel very young, and it did feel like he never got to see the full version of me. I mean, we're always changing and growing, but I was a pretty nasty teenager, so, you know, he got a lot of my worst years and not many of my best or my better, but, you know, he loved me through the teenage tantrums, so I'm lucky for that.
So do you feel nowadays that there's an awful lot you want to say to him?
There's things I know. So I got a tattoo recently and I know he would have hated that. And I know, you know, he knew my husband when we were teenagers because we started dating when we were 15. I know that he loved Mike. But there's so many things that I don't know. I don't know what he would have thought of this flat and the renovation we had on it, and, you know, but big things like what names we're thinking of calling our kids and my wedding dress or things like that. But then there's also, like, there's little, you know, I sometimes have arguments in my head with him about things that I've now found out about him later down the line that he never told me. And I'm like, God, Dad, you told me a completely different story about yourself when you were a teenager, and I've just found out that you were like this, and you made it sound like you were the perfect teenager, and you actually weren't. And I want to have an argument with you about that. And it's really weird, because you can't argue with a dead person, but those are the normal things that you miss, the kind of, the really profound things, obviously, but the little day goings on.
That sounds really tough. Yeah, I suppose you're the youngest person I've spoken to, really, and you're sort of saying that you weren't fully formed, aren't you?
No,
when you lost him.
Yeah, you know, like my I got very close to my dad because I left uni to care for him with my mum at 20, and we got very close during that period because he, you know, I was with him 24 hours a day. I was sleeping on the floor next to him, very codependent. And, you know, I often wonder if he had survived the cancer, what that relationship would have been like afterwards, because we were very close before, but to be that close. And, you know, I have a really special relationship with my mum on the other side of this. But how he would have been with me and whether or not perhaps he would have been more vulnerable with me, because he was always very stoic. And then when he got cancer, that completely fell down. And those are the kind of adult things that I feel like I never got to have conversations with him about mental health and, you know, what he had been through and his childhood. Because when you're a kid, you don't chat about those things. You know, giving him space to be a human being as well as my dad. Because I think when you're a kid and a teenager, your parents are just, you're very selfish in essence because you don't know any difference and you don't have the perspective. But he was just my dad, and everything was about what he could do for me and how he could, what relationship we had and what he was telling me to do or not do. But he was never, we never really had the opportunity for him to be a friend as well. And I have that with my mum now. So that's something, and for me to be a friend to him instead of somebody that he needed to, tell off or correct or advise, just somebody that could sit in the space together and kind of just be two people together. And that's hard because yeah, there's so much unsaid in that. But I'm really lucky because I did have time with my dad, but it was really one-on-one, and all of the big things were said. All of the, that I have no regrets about the way that I was there for my dad. And I have no feelings that he didn't know how much I loved him and how much he loved me. But it's just all the little everyday things, that you don't, get to talk about.
Still clearly very raw for you, isn't it? 7 years on.
I think, yeah, I think, I'm giving myself space to just be vulnerable about it right now because I'm really happy talking about my dad and I'm really happy talking about death. And I think maybe I'm now in a period where I don't have as much space to do that because life is busy and people expect you to move on. So to have a space to just really focus on my dad, even though it's half an hour, but I don't really give myself that much time to do that anymore. So yeah, it's probably bringing up a lot of feelings. I also think that for me, at 21, it felt like my entire identity. Like when I graduated, so I went to drama school. Drama school was really difficult. They were very unsupportive and had a pretty tough time. And when I graduated, a year later than I should have, because I'd taken a year out for my dad, at the graduation, the head of the course, who wasn't very supportive at all, she gave everyone a word to describe them. So, I'm plucking this out of my brain, but this is Anna and she's artistic, and this is David and he's, I don't know, dramatic or whatever. And there was ever and it was Rosie, and then she said resilient, and that actually really upset me because it's like, I've been here for 3 years training as an actor. I'm an incredibly creative person. I've got so many skill sets. I'm a good friend. But the only thing that you see me as is someone who's been through something traumatic. And I am resilient, and that is a good word for me. But that she was picking defining words for people from their journey. And that's all she could think about for me. And I got a huge cheer when I went up, and it was like, these aren't people cheering for me because I'm their mate. Some of them were, but a lot of them were cheering for me because I was the girl whose dad died. And that's all they knew me as because I came back halfway through the years because no one knew me. And so the point I'm getting to with that is that it felt like my entire identity. And now, I work with a company who knew me from sort of 26, 27 onwards. And I think when I first left drama school and I was first working with people, it felt like I needed to say it really quick, like, oh, and my dad's dead. It would be like, hi, my name's Rosie, I'm X number of years old, and my dad's dead. It was like in my top five characteristics. And now I don't feel like it needs to be so high up there. But then also, which is nice because it feels like it's not my entire identity. Before it felt like I literally didn't have anything else to offer except for grief. On the flip side of that, it is part of my identity, and maybe less people who meet me now know that because I've got more used to putting it further down the list. If that makes sense.
But it's a very difficult concept, all of this, isn't it? What do you tell new people when you first meet them? What don't you tell them? Because it's going to come up at some point, I guess, and it might come up in a hurtful way if you haven't prepared people. On the other hand, you don't barge straight in and say, hello, I'm so and so, and my father or my husband's just died, do you? Because you don't want to ruin the moment, really, I suppose.
I mean, I'm a bit of a chronic oversharer. You'll see I've had no problem jumping straight in. So that combined with the fact that at the time it did feel like such a overwhelming part of who I was, I think it did come up really quickly and I felt like I had to say, particularly because as a creative, you're expected to bring your trauma and your experience into the room all the time. And that to be part of what informs your work. And now I think it comes up much more organically and I don't think about it, whereas before I'd be like, oh, I need to say as soon as possible that that's what's going on in case something comes up or in case somebody puts their foot in it and I don't want to make them feel awkward or whatever. Whereas now it's much more organic, but there are still times where it gets unstuck and there's been, I think there's only been one occasion since my mum started dating her new partner, and then obviously they've got married. There was one occasion where it was actually on a really unfortunate day that was already a tricky day because of my dad, because it was the day he got diagnosed. And somebody said, like, oh, is your dad paying or is your dad something like that? And I was like, no, it's not my dad, it's not my dad. And since then, I've not had to navigate that. But that's an example where it's like, do I just let that go? Does it really matter? I really like the guy. He's doing his best. He doesn't need to have, and that this cashier doesn't need to feel bad about the fact they put their foot in. But for me, it feels massive and really triggering. But at the end of the day, people are just trying to do their best and live their lives and they make assumptions about people and I don't know, maybe I'm leaning towards a place where I have to be more comfortable with that. And, the same way if somebody says, oh, no, are your mum and dad coming to watch you at the show tonight? They're not meaning anything by it, but it still hurts. And it's whether or not it's going to do damage or good to be correct them or not.
Think that's one of the most difficult things to navigate, isn't it? Because your mind and heart and body and everything is so full up with what's just happened to you. And to see the outside world going on behaving as normal, like your cashier having an ordinary day and wanting to say to you, have a nice day, when you know your partner's just died or your father's just died, it's really hard for us to do.
I think I'm less, on the whole, much less sensitive to that when I was. I'd be like quite angry if somebody would, say, oh, where's your dad? Or is your dad picking you up? Or whatever. When I was younger, but I think that it's not their fault my dad's died. And they don't know. But there'll be definitely more occasions like that moving forward, because there is now a like male father figure in my life, and we've really established that that doesn't need to be a dad replacement or even a stepdad replacement. So I don't need that, I'm 27. I don't, but we're about to have a kid, and that kid is going to be their grandparents, and navigating all of that is going to be exciting and really, like, I think it's going to be really joyful, and I want to keep it in a joyful space. But again, I've got to give myself permission to not jump to being angry at when people say the wrong thing because they don't know. But yeah, it's definitely something that I think I'm always going to have to learn, and something I'm really bad at. I don't know if you have like an opinion on this, is like, do I have a dad? I had a dad. I don't have a dad. I used to have a dad. I literally don't know. I have no idea how to describe my dad at all. Because I have a dad in that I grew up having a dad, but he's not here. So I don't have a dad now. That's.
But I guess he's always with you.
Yeah, in a spiritual and an emotional way, but in a practical way, like I've got some plastering I need doing, and if my dad was here, he would have done the plastering. So I still find that language fairly tricky to navigate on a micro level with myself in conversation because I don't want to dismiss his existence, but also it's not helpful for me to talk about him like he's still here because he's not. And I like it's not helpful for me to describe about him in a way that makes me, you know, maybe tricks my brain to think he is here, but he did exist. So that's, I have no answers for that, but that's something that maybe comes up sometimes.
That's why we want to keep on talking about them, isn't it? Because we know they existed and we know they still exist in our minds and our hearts, and we don't want them to be forgotten.
Absolutely. I have an amazing friend who never met my dad,
Oh.
but she and has only ever really known me as somebody who is grieving, which is quite a weird thing. It's sort of like I'm like, she's never really known me completely happy, which is actually really sad. But she is the person who has made the most effort to get to know my dad
How
and
interesting.
talks about him the most out of my friends. My friends are really good, and a lot of them knew and loved my dad. And so he's not forgotten about in conversation at all. But she's the one who keeps his memory alive the most because she's genuinely fascinated to get to know him through me.
How lovely.
And that's amazing. That's amazing. And I think my biggest piece of advice for people who have a friend who's like lost a family member or whose parent has died or whatever it happens to be is like, how can you help keep their memory alive, or how can you talk about them in a way where you're still interested in them as a person, not just as a kind of a fact, oh, this person died, or this person was this age, or this person had this disease or cancer or illness or accident, whatever. It's like, oh, actually, you know, what was his favorite ice cream flavor, and how would he have responded to that thing that you've just told me about, and you know, do you think he would have been like this or this at your wedding day? And she asks great questions about him, and I feel like she's got such a good picture in her head about what he's like because she actually really listens and wants to know.
You're very lucky to have her as a
Oh
friend,
yeah,
aren't you?
very
Yeah.
lucky.
And I guess when you were 21, most of your circle had not experienced grief or the loss of a parent, had they? So you were on your
No,
own, really.
on my own, or like people would be like, oh, my cat died.
Oh.
So I know how you're feeling, or like, you know, most people had maybe like had a grandparent die at that point. I think I struggle with comparison with grief quite a lot. Even actually, literally the other week, somebody said to me like, I know exactly. I've been at a lot of weddings recently. I've got one more to go, and I've had five every weekend for the last 5 weeks.
Gosh.
And obviously they can be quite true. Like I went to one on Saturday where they had like a daddy daughter dance and he did a speech and,
Oh.
you know, my husband's there like gripping my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was like, oh yeah, that mu you know, that speech must have been really difficult to you, but I totally understand because my stepdad died, you know, a couple of years ago, and it's not helpful to me. Like, separate those things. I'm really sorry you feel like that, or I hope you're okay. It made me feel like this because I also went through this. And although they're different, I bet there's some feelings that have come up the same. But I don't find direct comparisons particularly helpful because I literally cared for my dad every day. I dealt with like huge medical crises every day. And my relationship with my dad is not the same relationship that this person had had with his stepdad and, you know, all of these things. And so, really, except for my mum and brother, there's sort of no one that I really want to have that conversation with. Even though they're trying to be really helpful, but I think definitely when I was 21, that was the thing that people felt like they could do is say like, oh, I totally get that because the pet, the grandparent, the, which is kind because they're just trying to go, I'm a human being, you're a human being, and we've had same experiences. But I think it felt so vastly away from what my world was supposed to be like that I didn't really find that very helpful, and I still don't really. It's nice to know when somebody's been through something that they can relate to you, but to say, oh yeah, I totally get how you're feeling, or I feel the same, is it doesn't really work for me.
This seems to come up a lot in whenever I talk about grief with people, that the kind of person who's been bereaved wants to find someone who has shared the same experience if possible, so that young mums want to find other young mums who've lost their partners, and parents of children want to find other parents of children who've been through a similar thing. But yours is a very unique experience to you, isn't it? And it's unlikely you'd have found anybody out there who
No,
could have gone through the
yeah.
same.
And I also think, even within my family, you know, we all have our own experiences of that moment. Like, for example, the moment I found out my dad had cancer, I decided there and then that I was going to leave uni. And when I told my parents, that felt like a really empowering decision and felt actually very positive and probably is the best decision I've ever made in my entire life. And I'm so proud of myself that I had the, like, I don't know, I felt like at that moment my feet just rooted into the ground. It felt really visceral, like just everything just went, woof, I'm here now. And for my mum, that moment is one of the most traumatic moments because her daughter was giving up what she wanted to do, and nobody wants to see their child have to parent their parent. And so that's an example of a moment where it's like probably quite empowering for me and quite triggering and challenging for my mum. And I think after my dad died, I was maybe seeking from my mum and brother to have the same responses to things as me, thinking like, they're the same, they're the only people that have this experience who know. My brother is the only other person who has experienced this dad dying. But they responded in completely different ways from what I expected, and it took like counselling and time to realise that that's not their fault, that they're not responding in the same way as me. And now it's, actually, I guess there's maybe some beauty in that, that we've all been through that same thing, and yet we see different light and dark in the moment. And I do have to remind myself of that because I think my natural go-to instinct as a neurodivergent person is to expect that everybody feels the same way as me, or to predict a response and then be really disappointed when people don't do the thing that my brain said that they were going to do. So I have to really challenge myself to be like, oh, they might not be feeling like this. It's not your job to make that decision for them. They need to get there on their own. And it's okay if they don't feel the same way as you because you're your brain and they've got their own brain and their own feelings. But definitely something I really struggled with to start with.
And now?
I think in general, everything sits much more comfortably now. There's days where it's bad or moments, but I know what those moments are and I'm able to like scaffold support around myself to not let it spiral. And I think like particularly me and my brother have worked through a lot to get to a place where we understand each other a lot better. And now I think I'm just really lucky to have people in my life who did remember my dad and who did were there for those moments. It wasn't just me in a sea of dark, they were there. They were in their own boat, maybe shining a light in a different direction, but they were there. So I think now it's brought us closer together. And in general, I think I'm able to support them more because I'm more supported in myself.
You mentioned earlier on, before we started the interview proper, that the scaffolding thing, you needed to prepare yourself for today and you needed to leave yourself space to do this interview with me because you knew how it would affect you. So you've learned a lot, obviously. I'm wondering if you've got some of that from counselling or mostly you've learned that yourself.
To be fair, I actually didn't have a huge amount of counselling. In hindsight, I got back very quickly. There may be some point though where I need to revisit stuff, I'm sure. I don't think it's ever going to go away. And I don't think I'm ever going to, like, I've nailed this grief thing. I'm doing great. There'll be points where I fall back in the hole, I think I'm very lucky that I do have a really, really good support network who have let me work things out for myself in a very supportive way. And I have come from a family who talk about death really openly. So it was never taboo. And it was never, you'll even notice that I don't really use metaphors for grief. Oh, sorry, for death. I just say death, died. That's my preference. It makes people quite uncomfortable and sometimes they squirm, which I probably secretly enjoy quite a lot. Because they're like, oh, passed on, lost. Or like, your father's in another place now. I'm like, no, he's not. He's dead. Which is probably me being a little bit dark, but I just don't. That's what works for me, is that language. So I think the lack of counselling that I maybe had long term was very much okayed by the fact that I had a space where I can talk, and I'm a very like verbal processor. So I think having people around me that I can talk to about stuff, the friend who wanted to know about my dad, or you know, my mum just being incredible talking about grief, and my husband who just kind of would listen, just an amazing listener. I think all of those things helped me. But I also think it, the reason that I now know now what I need in order to cope with a bad day or with a triggering situation is because I got into those holes so many times, and it felt so overwhelming, and it felt so like, how am I ever going to get out of this? Like, I think you do start recognizing patterns. Well, like if I know a difficult day is coming up, you know, like I knew my wedding was going to be upsetting, and so rightly or wrongly, I really avoided conversations talking about my dad the week before, because I just couldn't. I knew that if I went there emotionally, I was going to get myself in a complete and utter state. And actually, my dad wouldn't want that before I got married, and it would be too painful. And I, you know, at that moment, I knew that my stress levels were too high, and I was too emotional and too overwhelmed to safely get into that space. So I just didn't. I gave myself time before and after that week to be upset about my dad. And, you know, it's not like I'm scheduling in my diary, like, have a good cry about dad. But, you know, like a song will come on the radio, or it'll be the middle of the night, or I see a social media post that reminds me of him, or where we went to our honeymoon. I have lots of memories associated to my dad. And I, like, I'll feel those things, but just that week before, I had to put myself in protective mode. And I think that's something I'm quite good at doing in a way that isn't reductive. Like, I'm not going, you can't feel these things, shut down, don't talk about these things, don't do these things. It's just about going, okay, here's your mental health at the moment. You know that grief makes you feel X, Y, and Z, but you're already feeling X, Y, and Z. So if you add that into the mix, is that going to be helpful right now? And can you actually physically cope with that without going into a horrible spiral? And sometimes I can, and sometimes I need to go, actually, no, Dad, I'm going to have to put you on a shelf for a couple of days because it's too painful. So I was really proud of myself at my wedding, actually, because I got through that time, like, really stable. I mean, not as a bride. As a bride, I was very stressed. It was very, very panicked. But I mean, like, as somebody grieving, I got through that process really. You know, like, I had said to my photographer beforehand, don't take pictures of me when people are talking about my dad because I'm going to be a mess. And actually, I wasn't. I was okay. I was teary, and there were moments that I got a lump in my throat or needed a squeeze or whatever. But I wasn't completely falling apart. And I think, had I not learnt that I need to protect myself from certain conversations and certain triggers before big events, I don't know if I would have been as solid on the actual day. And I'm kind of doing the same with the baby, because if I actually stop and think about it, I can't. Like, it's too much. It's too heartbreaking. So you've got to chop up that heartbreak a little bit and, you know, sprinkle it out. Because it all in one, it's too overwhelming, there's too much love. And I think the beginning of grief is that feeling where you can't control that, and where you can't support yourself out of that feeling of too much love and too much pain. You're just in it all the time, and there's no escape from it. And I think what I would tell people who are in that now is that you will learn to manage your grief, and not that your grief is managing you, which I think is where I'm at now. It's not that it's gone away. It's not that it's any less painful. It's just, I know, I guess it's maybe like, you know, if we're using grief metaphors, which people love to do, you know, it's like a body of water, which felt like you were drowning in it at the beginning. And now what I've done is like scooped it into vessels and containers. And sometimes they spill over, or there's too much. And so it, you know, it's the same grief, and it's all there, and it gets messy and overflows and all of these things, but I'm learning to kind of reduce them into manageable chunks. Because yeah, if I see it as an overall picture of like, oh my gosh, it's 7 years since I've lost my dad and all of these things have happened and he's missed all of these things, if I process that all at once, it just feels like I'm drowning again.
So you've talked about how you protected yourself and your emotions on your wedding day, but the day itself, how did it go?
It was an amazing day. We really like gave ourselves the opportunity to just make it completely unique to us. And so everyone just kept saying the whole day, like, this feels like you guys so much. But there were ways that we included dad in like every step. So the church that we got married in was the one that he had his funeral in and that he attended with the same priest who knew my dad. I didn't get walked down the aisle by someone else because I have a massive thing about not replacing my dad. There would have been people that I could have asked, but I didn't want to ask. I'm sure my mum would have happily have done it. I'm sure one of my uncles would have done it. I'm sure my brother would have done it. But for me, that was a real trigger. So Mike, my husband, came up and met me at the top of the aisle and we walked down together, which everyone said made them sob. And then my wedding ring is made out of the metal from his ring. And so is my brother's. My mum gave us permission to, well, she did it. She got them taken to a jeweler and melted down and made into two rings. And in one of our readings was about death and about the idea that, you know, marriage is until death, but actually after death, you still have a relationship with that person. And that was partly because of dad that I put that in. And then he was in the speeches, but just really sensitively done. I think my mum and brother did quite a fun, light-hearted speech where they got everyone up and they turned it into a game. Because I think, again, it's that thing about, you know, containing the grief in ways that it feels like it's not going to overwhelm you. I know that if they had done a speech where it was really emotional and they were talking about my dad, it would have just felt completely overwhelming and they wouldn't have got through it. But also, then it feels like dad's the center of attention, and actually, he's not supposed to be the center. And if he was alive, he wouldn't be the center of attention. So, how do you include him in those speeches and in those moments without it just feeling like it's the dead dad show all the time, which is how I used to feel, you know, that really strong part of my identity. But now I can go, hang on a minute, pipe down for a bit. So he was in the speeches, but in a really like jokey, light way with my mum and brother. And then it got a bit more serious at the end. And he was in my speech and he was in my husband's speech. And then in the orders of service, there was just a page where it said, wishing you were here. And it was just a picture of all of the people because, you know, my husband had lost people as well. And, you know, my grandparents had died. And so he was in it, peppered through, but it didn't feel like he suffocated the joy. Not him, the grief. It didn't feel like the grief suffocated the joy. Everyone there knew that I had a dead dad. Everyone there knew that it was painful. But no, I hope nobody was going home sobbing.
And you?
No, I wasn't at all. I felt really in control and really, really proud of myself. I was so proud of myself that I got through the whole day without losing control. And I think if it had been a couple of years ago, I don't think I would have been able to do that because I just think it felt too overwhelming. It sounds like really stupid, but if I don't control and manage my grief, it will control and manage me. And sometimes it does. And that's when you let yourself have a crappy day when you're in bed and you're in tears all day, or you let yourself watch the movie that you know is going to make you sob, or you go get counselling because you feel like that is just you're in too deep with that. And so I'm not saying it's a bad thing when your grief is controlling you, but I think that we are going to live with this for the rest of our lives, and it is going to be part of who we are for the rest of our lives. Because the fact of the matter is, it's not going anywhere. So how do we make it our friend, and how do we you know, kind of make it manageable in a day-to-day? I make mistakes all the time, but I think I know that I'm learning, and I think I'll be learning my entire life about how to live with my grief and how to make it my friend and keep it in its containers, but make space for it when it needs to overflow. Hopefully, at some point, Not even realizing that I'm doing it.
You seem to me to have learned an awful lot, Rosie, and
Thank you.
Full of admiration for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you ever so much. Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.